Today is Monday, April 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
More than 75,000 people who have fled Islamic State's last stronghold in Baghouz are living in overcrowded, desperate conditions in an Al-Hol camp.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also ahead, a 41-year-old television actor wins a landslide victory in the Ukrainian presidential election, and the U.S. is ending sanctions waivers for Iranian oil importers. It's all on today's International Edition. A Sri Lankan official says a local militant group with help from an international network is responsible for the Easter Sunday attacks on churches and hotels in Sri Lanka that killed 290 people and injured 500 others. The country's health minister, Rajitha Senaratne, said today that the National Tawheed Jamaat organization is responsible for the suicide bombings. He added there was an international network without which these attacks could not have succeeded. Saratne said the attacks at six locations, three churches, and three hotels were carried out by seven suicide bombers. All of the suicide bombers were Sri Lankan citizens, he said. A van exploded today near one of the churches that was bombed on Sunday. Police attempted to defuse the bombs found in the van, but they exploded. No injuries have been reported. U.S. President Donald Trump tweeted heartfelt condolences from the people of the United States to the people of Sri Lanka on the horrible terrorist attacks on churches and hotels. We stand ready to help. Marcus Harton brings us more from Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi.
The first six blasts that began around 8:45 local time were coordinated and claimed most of the fatalities, while two smaller blasts took place several hours later. The capital, Colombo, where three major hotels and one church were targeted, bore the brunt of the mayhem. Christian groups have said they face increasing intimidation from hardline Buddhist monks in recent years. However, such harassment is on a relatively minor level, says Jahan Pereira, who heads the National Peace Council in Colombo.
Who target Catholics? There have been anti-Christian sentiment, but it's on a very small scale with regard to these little conversions that are happening in different localities, but not to the extent where people were being killed.
Condemnation of the deadly bombings came in from leaders across the world, including U.S. President Donald Trump. For reporter Anjana Pasricha, this is Marcus Harton, VOA News, Washington.
Well, the United States today said it is ending sanctions waivers for five countries importing Iranian oil, hoping to put new pressure on Tehran to curb its military aggression in the Mideast by cutting off its main source of national revenue. The White House announced that President Donald Trump had decided to end the waivers on May 2nd for three allies, Japan, South Korea, and Turkey, as well as China and India. Three other countries, Italy, Greece, and Taiwan, had already acceded to U.S. demands to end their purchases of Iranian oil. Well, for more on this story, joining me from the U.S. State Department in Washington is State Department correspondent Cindy Sain. And Cindy, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
Well, Cindy, really, what does this mean for Iran?
Well, Iran has already reacted to this defiantly, as one might expect, saying that they were expecting this and that they're prepared and that they know how to neutralize such actions. At the same time, kind of dismissing, but also saying that if its exports of oil is majorly disrupted, then they may even close the Strait of Hormuz, which is a major oil shipment channel in the Gulf.
Also, and how will this affect trade with the U.S.?
Well, one of the main importers, as I'm sure you know, is China. And China's foreign ministry has already reacted as well, saying that China opposes the U.S. imposition of unilateral sanctions and long-arm jurisdiction, and that China's business with Iran is transparent and legal. So this could certainly affect already sensitive trade talks going on between the U.S. and China, where things at least had been, you know, sort of people had been cautiously optimistic. optimistic about it until now. This also impacts India and Turkey. India so far has been a rather cautious, saying it hopes that the waivers, you know, will not go away right away, whereas the Turkish foreign minister also tweeted and condemning and saying this was not good for stability in the region at all.
And also just looking at the humanitarian aspect of this, how will this affect people?
Well, and that's what a lot of critics of the Trump administration policy on Iran have pointed out, that that will affect everyday civilians who are already suffering in Iran. And but the U.S. says it is hoping to choke off Iran's main national source of revenue in order to change the behavior of the government.
If Iran, as you have mentioned, they have already responded and, as you say, defiantly, so then what's the next step?
Well, that's a good question, and we're all kind of waiting to see whether, you know, whether it's more of a letting off steam. And I think some of the countries, though, that had the waivers were expecting that the exceptions would continue. So it is a bit of a shock, and perhaps a bit of a shock to the markets, which are already volatile because of the situation in Venezuela, which is also a big oil producer. So we had, first of all, crude prices going up, so a bit of uncertainty right now.
Okay, and I know that Iran does have supporters, so do you think they will gain more support?
Well, that is possible to see. That what it will be interesting to see what countries like China and India and others do now, if they are really pushed into a corner and more or less forced to choose.
Okay, thank you so much. That's State Department correspondent Cindy Sain in Washington.
Thank you.
Among the top stories in the world, a strong earthquake in northern Philippines today left several people dead, trapping others in buildings and damaging the capital's secondary airport. Leaders of Pakistan and Iran agreed today to expand border security cooperation to fight terrorist groups waging deadly attacks in both countries. And Sudan's Transitional Military Council wants protesters to remove themselves and the blockades they have placed around the military headquarters in Khartoum. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
What do Earth and planet Mercury have in common? Well, both are two of the solar system's rocky inner planets, and both also have metallic cores. While scientists have known for a while that Mercury's outer core is composed of liquid metal, they've only had a few slight clues that its inner core was solid like Earth's. Now, scientists are reporting that they have found evidence that the inner core of Mercury is indeed solid and that its size is close to that of Earth's inner core. It's said that Mercury's core fills almost 85% of the planet's total volume. By comparison, Earth's core, according to the U.S. Geological Survey, represents only 15% of our planet's total volume. To make their findings, the researchers studied data gathered by NASA's 2011 to 2015 Messenger mission to Mercury. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs is calling on countries to repatriate thousands of wives and children of Islamic State militants in Syria who are living in dire conditions in the Al-Hol camp in Al-Hasakeh, governorate in northeast Syria. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from OCHA headquarters in Geneva.
More than 75,000 people who have fled Islamic State's last stronghold in Baghouz are living in overcrowded, desperate conditions in an Al-Hol camp. Women and children comprise 90% of the population. Among them are more than 11,000 foreign women and children, including those born of a foreign father or mother. Governments have expressed reluctance to repatriate their nationals who left their countries of origin to join the Islamic State militant cause in Syria. But regional humanitarian coordinator for the Syria crisis, Panos Mumsis, says all member states have an obligation under international law to repatriate their own nationals. He says no one should be rendered stateless. MUMSIS is appealing to states to accept the children who have the nationality of their foreign mother or father. He says children should be treated first and foremost as victims. He tells VOA, children have special rights for protection that apply in all situations.
This has to be irrespective of the children's age, sex, and including any perceived family affiliation. The perceived family affiliation should really not affect the determination of the best interests of the child. So it's really a special plea for the children.
The UN Children's Fund estimates there are about 2,500 children living with their mothers in a separate area of the Al-Hol camp. MUMSIS explains the women are being kept apart from the rest of the population to reduce tensions. He says there is hostility toward them because of their suspected involvement with IS fighters. He says the area where the foreign women and their children are staying is more restricted than the rest of the camp. He says the United Nations has not been allowed to access the area, which is run by the Kurdish-led Syrian Defense Forces. MUMSIS says the International Committee of the Red Cross is one of a few organizations allowed to go in and out. He says the United Nations provides the ICRC with life-saving supplies, which they distribute to the residents. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. Well, today marks the third and final day of a constitutional referendum in Egypt that could allow President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi to remain in office until 2030. Opponents say the referendum is marred by corruption and coercion, and the measure will roll back the democratic dreams of 2011, when a popular uprising led to the ousting of the 30-year dictator Hosni Mubarak. Supporters say a secure leadership will make Egypt safer and help the country climb out of an economic crisis. The outcome of the ballot is all but certain to most observers. For weeks, the Egyptian media, which are overwhelmingly pro-government, have been promoting yes votes. No organized opposition has emerged to challenge the message. The military, which is a huge part of the Egyptian economy, will also increase its role in the criminal justice system if the measure passes. Since ousting former President Mohamed Morsi in 2013, after mass protests calling for his resignation, Sisi's government has been accused of jailing the opposition. The Egyptian parliament overwhelmingly supported the changes and announced the national vote last Wednesday. Results are expected by April 27th. Well, the Zimbabwe Constitutional Court recently banned corporal punishment of children in the judicial system. Child advocates call it a positive step toward respecting children's rights. There are growing calls to entirely ban corporal punishment in schools and within families. Reporter Kuzai Zvinovashi has more.
Spare the rod and spoil the child is an old adage that many parents, teachers, and guardians have lived by for decades. Now that is changing in Zimbabwe, where the Constitutional Court recently banned corporal punishment as a sentence for convicted children under the age of 18. Reverend Taylor Nyanete is the chairman of Zimbabwe National Council for Welfare of the Children. He says Zimbabwe should follow the footsteps of several other African nations.
In other parts of Africa, it's not applied. There is no corporal punishment for children. South Africa is one, Malawi is one, Zambia is one, Kenya is one, Tanzania is one country that has done away with the corporal punishment. In terms of family, it was happening, it is still happening, but the Concord is of the opinion that that should also go. As a country, we ascended to the UNCRC, we attended to the African Charter, and these instruments are very clear on corporal punishment.
He adds that the Zimbabwean constitution does not allow corporal punishment elsewhere. Zimbabweans have mixed feelings about the banning of corporal punishment. Some people think it is essential in the upbringing of a well-behaved individual. But Nyanete says corporal punishment has long-term effects and needs to be a thing of the past.
If it's outlawed in law, once the child reports, then the guardian or parents will be arrested and taken to court. Research is showing that physical harm to a person traumatizes that child, and it affects their relationship with other siblings with other people, even going to adulthood. That's why you find domestic violence quite common in marriages. It's because of the socialization.
Obet Masaraure, the president of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union, says banning corporal punishment is broad-minded.
The majority of teachers in Zimbabwe would still want to apply corporal punishment because they were never trained for other alternatives that we can use. Outlawing corporal punishment is progressive because at the end of the day, it enhances our capacity as a society to respect human dignity.
Masaraure and Nyanete agree that there are many ways of disciplining children that do not involve beating them. They include detaining them, taking away some of their privileges, such as watching TV, and even assigning more duties to them. Nyanete says Parliament has an education bill that is at a consultative stage with the public. If passed, it will emphasize a zero-tolerance policy on corporal punishment in schools. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zhinavashe from Harare.
This is VOA's International Edition.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Well, today is Earth Day, which commemorates the birth of the environmental movement. For nearly 70 years, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gary Snyder has combined a profound respect for the big nature of the American West with a Zen Buddhist perspective that celebrates, cares for, and learns from the natural world. In this report, VOA's Adam Phillips profiles Gary Snyder, a man for whom every day is Earth Day.
With his deeply furrowed skin and unruly white beard, the poet Gary Snyder looks every bit the wizened sage as he reads an excerpt of a poem by Han Shan. This Chinese poet lived over 1,100 years ago in a cave deep in the wilderness.
The path to Han Shan's place is laughable. A path, but no sign of cart or horse. Converging gorges, hard to trace their twists. A thousand grasses bend with dew. A hill of pines hums in the wind. And now I've lost the shortcut home.
Snyder says he is intimately familiar with the wild landscapes of Japan, where he lived and studied Zen Buddhism as a young man. And he knows the winding trails of California's Sierra Nevada mountain range, his home for many years.
A trail is really a handy thing. It's a lot easier to hike on a trail than it is to crash through the brush. But in earlier times, before village agriculture, people went into the woods and the fields and the marshes to gather the various things they needed. You want to dye something, you go into the woods and marshes to look for the dye plants. If you want berries, you go where the berry patches are. If you're going fishing or hunting, you know where to go, to a marsh, a lake, a stream. So the trail is only useful to get you to where you're going to leave the trail. What you really want is not on the trail most of the time. That's true in life, too.
In this reading from his poem, Off the Trail, Snyder recalls the pleasures of a trackless wilderness.
We are free to find our own way over rocks, through the trees, where there are no trails. The ridge and the forest present themselves to our eyes and feet, which decide for themselves, in their old, learned wisdom of doing, where the wild will take us.
Snyder says there is also a unique fellowship between humans and nature that is embodied in one's home place.
And people like myself, who are watershed bioregionalists, were particularly interested in where the original streams were and can we find them again and maybe daylight some of them.
Daylighting refers to efforts to identify natural streams that have been diverted or paved over and restore them to their original state. Concerns about the natural environment are especially keen in California, where farmers depend on melting snowpack each spring to irrigate their fields.
And if global warming causes less snow to fall and to melt faster and turn it into just rain so it runs off in the winter, that'll be the end of California agriculture.
Despite his concern about the enormous damage humans have done to the environment, Snyder is hopeful such practices are changing. And he's confident, too, in the power and resilience of nature.
We really have to work on improving our style here and clean up our act. And if we don't, we'll maybe be in very bad trouble and also cause a lot of trouble for other beings. But then you can also say, given the longer cycles of planetary change, nature always bats last.
The poet Gary Snyder was born in 1930 and is the author of over 30 volumes of poetry and prose, including, most recently, This Present Moment, New Poems. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Thank you, Adam. Well, as we observe World Immunization Week, we're going to focus on a disease that could be eradicated from the earth, just like smallpox was, and just as international programs are doing with polio. But instead, as we hear from Carol Pearson, this deadly disease is making a comeback.
Measles is a disease that is found only in humans, so it could be completely wiped off the face of the earth, just like smallpox was. But despite a highly effective and safe vaccine, measles is making a comeback. In just the first 3 months of this year, the World Health Organization reports that cases of measles has tripled over last year. In Africa, the situation is worse. Africa saw a 700% increase compared to last year.
Madagascar has almost 1,000 deaths. It has, you know, tens of thousands of infections.
This is Brooklyn, New York, where a measles outbreak among Hasidic Jews prompted the mayor to declare a state of emergency. The National Institutes of Health warns that a decline in measles vaccination is causing a preventable global resurgence of this often deadly disease, including in the U.S. Before the vaccine became available in the 1960s, about 2 million people around the world would die from measles. In the U.S., 3 to 4 million people were infected every year.
1 in 10 children who get infected with measles will get an ear infection that could cause deafness. 1 in 20 would get pneumonia. 1 in 1,000 would get brain swelling, what we call encephalitis. And 1 to 3 per 1,000 would die. So to say that measles is a trivial disease is completely incorrect.
The complications are even worse in poor countries.
You start off with children who are already at greater risk. They may be malnourished. They may have immune system compromise. They may have underweight, and they may have no access to health care. So measles is a big killer.
You have a 90% chance of getting measles if you haven't been vaccinated and you come in contact with someone who has it.
So it's very infectious. And so it will find everybody who is not protected against measles.
The solution is to get 2 doses of the measles vaccine. That may mean educating parents about the disease and the vaccine. Equally important is making vaccination a priority of health systems worldwide. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Well, over now to the Ukraine, where Volodymyr Zelensky, a 41-year-old television actor, won a landslide victory in the Ukrainian presidential election yesterday, with exit polls showing he received about 73% of the vote in the final round, nearly 3 times as many as his rival, the incumbent Petro Poroshenko. Conceding defeat yesterday evening, Poroshenko offered his congratulations to Zelensky and added, "I will leave the office, but I want to announce firmly I will not leave politics." Poroshenko later wrote on Twitter, "You may just look at the celebrations in the Kremlin on the occasion of the elections. They believe that with a new, inexperienced Ukrainian president, Ukraine could be quickly returned to Russia's orbit of influence." You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.